people. It was just one of those. I don't know. It's just one of those nights where everything seemed like a struggle, and
you could never get the run. I was also waiting for the run. It just felt like it was kind of hanging between 9 and 7. You know, you were making some plays. You were starting. I thought Miles made a few big plays defensively, got hands on the basketball, but it just could not get that run. And it was a, I think you kind of call it between the tackles kind of game out there tonight, where it was hard to get a real flow going, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it just seemed like when we did get something going, something happened. Yep. That set it back. We fouled, or they made a shot, or we turned it over, or, you know, and I felt like you got our rotations out of sync a little bit, and it just felt like one of those nights where things didn't matter kind of what happened, things just kind of didn't go our way, and it felt like a struggle all night long. And
at near the end, you still had that opportunity where your guys kept getting the ball back. You had 4 opportunities to make it a one possession game.
Yeah.
That was kind of a microcosm of the night, where just great looks, great effort, but just not able to quite finish it off.
I guess for me it's just hard, because I look at it and I felt like I was actually surprised we were in the game with how it felt. And it just seemed like our guys were struggling all night. And they give them credit. They continued to battle, and I thought the effort was great, and I thought our resilience was good, and we had some grit to us that was good to see. But I just felt like we let one slip, and we got a little out of character. I don't know what we got. We got destroyed at the free throw line.
Yeah.
I don't know if you got the numbers, Chad.
23 of 31 for them, and 9 of 13 for you.
Yeah, and it was a home game for us, so you figure that out.
I know.
23 of 31, 31 free throws. Hard to absorb that.
No, not going to go any deeper into it either.
Yeah. Yeah, and so it's it. But, I mean, you're on your home court, and you get doubled up at the free throw line, I mean, and you lose by 4. So, yeah.
And I guess the only thing I will say is, when we talk about your defense, there were times where your defense was doing the right thing, and – little hooks were getting let go. That's hard. Again, not to make excuses, but at the same time, it felt like there were moments in that game where, doggone it, you were doing the right things and not getting rewarded for it. That can make it difficult.
Yeah, and then I felt like, you know, there were opportunities where we had it, and like you said, we missed a shot, or we missed multiple shots, or we turned it over, or, you know, or we gave up a big defensive, you know, we gave up an offensive rebound just things where it was like it didn't seem what was going to happen. But I was proud of how we fought, and
well,
forget about it, but these conference ones where it's your home court.
Yeah.
Those are the ones that you struggle to let go, because you got to get these ones.
Well, I guess the good news is you just have to go over there and get it later in the season, right?
Yep, absolutely.
Thanks, Coach, for coming up. We appreciate it.
See ya, thanks.
Coach Nate Lemons of the Wausau West Warriors, as the Warriors tonight come up short against DC Everest 64-60. Again, the Warriors 7-3 on the season still. Solid start, 2-1 in the conference, ever 6-5 overall, and they are 1-2 in the league. Well, thanks again to our sponsors. Without whose help, we could not bring you Wausau West Warrior High School Boys Basketball here on 98.9 WXCO. And thanks to you for joining us. Again, I'm Chad Holmes. This has been Wausau West Warrior High School Basketball on 98.9 WXCO.
This has been Wausau West Warrior High School Sports on 98.9 WXCO, online at WXCO.fm, mobile devices and Alexa by searching WXCO, and on the Civic Media app. Wausau West Sports has been brought to you by the Cloverbelt Credit Union, Red Robin Restaurants, Sun Printing, the Wausau West Athletic Department, and Coast to Coast Marketing. Thanks for joining us for Wausau West Warrior High School Sports on your home for the Warriors, 98.9 WXCO.
Hear it. See. You know, I walk people through a series of exercises and ask them questions, because I want to know what makes people come to a position where they believe that they want our government to operate like the company they work for. Because universally, when we get to the end of our spiel, I generally ask the very simple, very pointed question. Okay, if you believe that, are you okay with your boss and your CEO running the country? Is this how you live your life, how you work every day? When you come in here every day and you give your blood and sweat and tears, is this all around you what you want out of your government. And universally, I get this deer in the headlight look of, yeah, I didn't think of that. Because none of them are thrilled with who they work for. None of them are thrilled with the way things are operating. None of them are thrilled with the responses that they believe, that they gave me minutes ago, being in the hands of corporate interest. And I've compiled some of those. Because universally, what I get out of people is, well, you know, we'll operate government more efficiently. We're told business operates much more efficiently. They deserve, they deliver better services, better quality services. They reduce waste, fraud, and abuse. And, you know, if businesses were running things, you know, they would use the taxpayer dollar more efficiently, more judiciously. And I'll go, okay, you know, give me another one. Well, they like the idea of balanced budgets because it's like they think that they're at home, you know, and budget deficits, fiscal responsibility, and to a degree, small degree, corporate America might bring, no, never mind. Most of them are deep, deep in hock. They also believe that accountability would be brought by having a CEO, a dictator type. You know, making sure everyone's accountable because they believe that a business model emphasizes accountability, performance. My favorite, meritocracy. Oh, more transparency. Oh, you've heard it. More responsibility, all of that. They also throw out their innovation. You know, we're going to move at the speed of business. They're going to be more creative in finding new solutions. Because they do believe government's broken, and I don't disagree. And we'll get to that. Another one I've heard is, well, they'd be more responsive to us. It would focus on responsiveness to the. And I say, okay, have you tried to call customer service lately of any corporation in this country? And you know, I get a head down look. The other response I hear is, we're going to reduce bureaucracy. It's going to be the red tape. We're going to cut through the red tape because bureaucracy, slow, cumbersome, don't get things done. We need to move at the speed of business because the business of business is business. And you go, sometimes that's good and a lot of time that's bad. So, I don't know, competition, they're going to bring in some, you know, public-private partnerships and we're going to do those things that we need to get done, we're going to do them through partnerships with corporations. And they all come back to this idea of the free market, that somehow, you know, the free market, the invisible hand, is going to allocate resources much more better, much more effectively. It's going to, again, ferret out the waste, fraud, and abuse. Because we've been told this repeatedly, haven't we? That government is just slow, it's ineffective, it's bloated, it's costly, it's all these things we've been told. And yet we haven't really looked at the corporate boardrooms. We haven't looked at the amount of waste, fraud, and abuse in corporate America. You know why? Because we can't. Because it's mostly done behind closed doors without any accountability, which is, again, what we're told business-like structure would bring us. Another one I've heard is, well, we need to decentralize. And I'm going, are you sure you want to run like a business trying to be decentralized? The idea of having local, you know, local municipalities and local authorities, allowing them the autonomy to make decisions based on the community's needs, which I'm all in favor of, but that's not the corporate structure. Have you not seen our franchise system? Have you not seen the fast food industry where it's all the same all across the country? No deviation, no decentralization, no, hey, do what's in the best. No. And my favorite, we need to run the country like a business argument is, well, we're going to get lower taxes because businesses are going to compete. Somehow the government's going to compete. I don't know with who, but it's going to lead to lower taxes. We're going to destroy that invisible room that's titled waste, fraud, and abuse. And it's going to free up, you know, all these huge tax breaks to come back to working people. And to that I go, have you not gone grocery shopping? Have you not seen what corporate America has done for us? Have you seen the inflation of the last couple of years. That's corporate America doing that. That's not government. As much as we're told, Joe Biden did the inflation, he flipped the switch. No, no, that's corporate America. Because have you seen their balance sheets? Have you seen how well they've done? And again, I come back to this and I go, when they're done with all of these excuses, all of these reasons for why we need corporate governance, I come back to that basic question. Do you want the company that you work for running this country? Now, I have talked to some small business people who have said, yeah, I think the person that I work for, who I know where he lives, he shows up to work with me every day. I wouldn't mind him running things. Problem is, that's not who will be running things. Because I actually agree, a small mom and pop, somebody who has to balance the book at the end of the quarter and has to pay the taxes and does have to do all of the things that they lay out that the business principles would bring us, that's not the guy who's running things. The guy who's running things are these corporate CEOs who have crushed competition, who have crushed innovation, who have crushed anything that gets in the way of their profits. Because what we know, and we know this, and this is where I come back to where, okay, you said you want corporate governance. You want a government of, for, and by the corporate form. Well, understand, in every situation, without fail, corporate America prioritizes profits over you or anyone else. It's about the money. Whether it's education, whether it's healthcare, whether it's social services, whatever it is, corporate America, like it or not, corporate America is 110% about how do we make the most money? How do we squeeze the quarter to the eagle screams? How do we maximize shareholder wealth? And guess what, taxpayer? You wouldn't be considered a shareholder. You're the product. And look what they've done to their products over the years. Ask people my age and older whether the things that they bought today are as good as the things that they bought 30, 40, 50 years ago. If the quality is better. If the craftsmanship is better. If, oh, I don't know, the ability to do just about anything is somehow better. Ask that simple question. Because the reality is, again, time and time again, what we get is, well, we had to do this for the corporate interest. We had to do this because, well, we need to make money. We need to fatten the bottom line. We need to increase our profits. We've all heard these. We need to reduce redundancy. We need to go down the list of all of the things that we need to be doing to make corporate America happy. And ultimately, what it comes down to is we lose in every form. We, the taxpayers, get the short end of the stick again and again and again. So we know, without fail, it's always going to be profit over people. It's always going to be what they can line their pocket with over what you can. And I ask this question all the time, no matter who you work for, when things go bad, when times get tough, when the cuts have to be made, whose kids go hungry? Is it yours or is it the CEO's? Is it yours or is it the shareholders? And in every instance, people will, yeah, I guess we get laid off first. Yeah, we're the last to benefit and the first to be taken from. That's the life of a working person. So to have a working person tell me, gee, I want that in my government, kind of frightens me. Because what we know with corporate governance is cost cutting would be, well, that would be front and foremost. How do we make the engine run faster? Not better, but faster. How do we churn out more stuff? And it doesn't even have to be good stuff. So that means no job security for working people. That means at-will employment. That means gig kind of workers. That means all kinds of stuff. And, you know, the sad reality is we're in a position where unless we're ready to suffer in that way, we're going to be kind of screwed over. And again, every person I talk to about this, when you lay it out in a different way of, well, I just want business. I just want business to run. They kind of come around. Because understand, businesses in this country anyway, their focus is the next quarter. Their focus is the next business report. Their focus is the next day's stock ticker. Their goals are short term. Their goals are right now. They're immediate. How do I line my pockets right now? And what we know, and we're seeing this with a lot of big companies, they haven't invested in new technology. They haven't been innovative. They haven't been on the cutting edge. Their infrastructure is crumbling. Their ability to meet their customers' needs are crumbling because they're looking for the cheapest product. They're looking to find, hey, how can we outsource? How can we use AI? It's not about making lives better. It's about making profits better. So with this short-term kind of thinking, what do you think they're going to do to healthcare or education or infrastructure spending in this country or basically anything that has a long-term focus? The thing that government has that businesses don't really have is the ability to go for the next 100 years, what kind of investments do we want to make? Do we want to build an expensive bridge to nowhere that could eventually lead us to somewhere? Or do we want to take that resource that we would have used connecting those places and hoard it now? The other thing we know is we're living in the era of massive income inequality. We are living in an era where income inequality is just through the roof. We are living the new Gilded Age, and we know that. Every person that I talk to says that they're struggling to make ends meet. Every person is talking about how they're not sure how they're going to be able to pay the light bill or to put food on the table. They're struggling. The pain, the suffering is real. And I would argue in a corporate governance structure, it only gets worse because corporate governance only exacerbates income inequality by, of course, prioritizing the owners and the shareholders and the stakeholders at the top other than those at the bottom. And I tell you, look at the trickle-down economic theory that they've thrown at us. If we give rich people everything that they could possibly ever want, everything that their little hearts could ever dream of, that eventually it would do what? It would trickle down on us, right? It would come down, it would rain down like manna from heaven. It would be great. It would be the greatest thing since sliced bread. It'd be fabulous. What actually happened? What actually has happened is, well, they've hoarded all the money. We've created the largest billionaire class in the history of humanity. We got a guy worth almost $500 billion now. And he's telling us, oh, sorry, sorry. Well, you're going to have to tighten the belt a little bit because we're going to have to get things in line. Let that sink in for a minute. Do you really think the Elon Musks of the world care about average, everyday working people? Because here's the thing. Here's the punchline. I'm going to give you the punchline before I'm even done. The punchline is we're going to find out. The punchline is we're living the moment that everybody has told themselves that they want. You're getting what you want in this next administration. If you're a conservative, if you've told anyone that you want government to run more like a business, you're going to get it. And that means the poor, that means the marginalized, that means the vulnerable, that means people who are on the edge, you're all done. We're cutting those off. Medicaid's going to get cut. Medicare is going to get privatized. All of those things that conservatives have been up nights dreaming and fantasizing about, they're going to be moving on because corporate CEOs are going to be running the departments of our government. We are getting really, honestly, and truthfully, the very first corporate governance systems in this country right now. And we're going to get to see it firsthand. We're going to get to watch the carnage and how these folks who tell us we believe in accountability, well, lead us down a path of less accountability, less transparency, less oversight, and more, I would argue, of undermining the public trust and the entire democratic process. We're in for quite a ride. Not to mention, we're going to see more decline in services. If you think things are bad now, wait till you put a profit motive on top of all of this. It's only going to get worse. And we're going to privatize what's left. I mean, you stop and think about all of the things that we've privatized over the years. I mean, it's really fascinating. You know, I've often talked about the parking authorities. I've often talked about, you know, the turnpike systems. You know, I've talked about how they've privatized parts of education, how they've gone through a lot of the schemes to get what used to be the commons, what used to be our stuff, and put it into their hands. I've talked about that for a long time. I mean, you know, think about the airports. We used to run those ourselves. Now, how expensive is it? Airports are now privatized with private firms managing and operating them. And yet, what did we hear a while ago? Oh, we need to invest enormous sums of money because they've allowed them to go, well, what was the best line I ever heard? Thomas Friedman, the guy from the New York Times. He said he went from Beijing to LAX. And it was like going from the Jetsons to the Flintstones. That's where we are. Our education system's being privatized. Charter schools, private schools that are being funded by vouchers. All of these schemes to privatize education. We've privatized our water and our sewer supplies in cities across this country. Our healthcare, our transportation, our energy, our telecoms. All this stuff we've privatized. And in every scenario, every single one of them, we've been told the private sector is going to run it better. The private sector can do it better, faster, cheaper, more efficient. We're going to get better products, better service, cheaper prices. It's going to be utopia. And what we've gotten is exactly the opposite. And we all knew that that's what we were going to get. And somehow we act surprised. Oh, gee, we got the turnpike back and it's full of craters that we're going to have to invest a generation of money in to fix. Oh, gee, the prison system is terrible, and we're feeding food to people with maggots in it. Oh, gee. Surprise, it didn't work. Because all of these corporate schemes, all of these think tank tested, focus group tested, think tank approved schemes, they're not about better for you or me. They're about more for the handful. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Gonna take a quick break, right back after.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So the reason I bring this up, and again, I'm tired of hearing people talk about how much they want corporate America to run things. And I don't even know where it comes from on a logical position. Because, you know, as I said at the beginning, this idea of running corporate America of corporate America running our government is just incredible to me, because I know so many working people who seem to think they can run the businesses that they work for much better. And it's curious to me that this has taken hold. Now, is it the only alternative? Is it one of those situations, well, we don't like what we've got, so let's try something else, and the only other alternative being the corporate form? I disagree with that. I think that's the worst possible outcome. Because what we're going to do then is, as I said, the people who aren't the fortunate, the people who are on the margin. Well, me as a kid, I'll use myself, since we always bring things back to, in politics, back to our own situation. Growing up in a housing project with a single, the child of a single mother, in a situation where there was not a lot of opportunities for her. Public housing has pretty much been all done away with. Food stamps have been really hard to get for low-wage workers. And health care, virtually impossible for a lot of people. In fact, I saw something in Texas. The number of people in Texas that go without health care is just astronomical. And yet somehow, we want those to be our principles. So what's left of the social safety net, done, gone, over. And what was interesting, I had a conversation with a relative. Big Trump supporter. Big, big Trump supporter. On Social Security and Medicare. And we were talking about my current situation and how fortunate I am to have Teamsters health insurance and how, thank goodness for the union negotiating these benefits, that I have something that's been very, very, very helpful to me and has made my life a whole world better. And I said to her, I said, well, you know, what do you pay for healthcare? Because we were going through some of these conversations. Well, you know, I have Medicare and I pay like $183 a month or whatever the number was. And I said, well, you have traditional Medicare, right? And she goes, oh, yeah, no way I would get one of those Advantage plans. Those are garbage. And she's going on all of the things that are wrong with Medicare Advantage, which I'm like, yes, there's hope for you. Because you see what corporate governance gets us. Not great. Great sales pitch. Good commercials. Little sweeteners. Little trinkets and toys. But ultimately, the end of something really great. She's like, no, under no circumstances would I get rid of traditional Medicare. I go, here's the sad part. You may not have a choice because we're already over the halfway. We're on the other side of the hill towards total privatization. And I said, look, I predict Trump and you know, obviously RFK Jr. and Musk, especially with the little Doge boy. I assume that's the number one thing on their list. That's on their wet dream list. If Doge Boy had a fantasy, that's what it would be. Let's kill off Medicare, privatize it, profitize it. And oh, by the way, who would be the large holder of Medicare Advantage plans? Well, we already know who it is. It's United Health Group, the company that denies 32% of the claims. And this is what I brought up to my relative. What happens when you get United Health Group or someone like that or someone worse? When that happens, at your age, can you live through a couple of denials? At your age, 6 months of fighting to get treatment that you need, could that end your life? And the light bulb kind of came on. So for me, as I've been saying from the very beginning, the day Trump won, I've said the same thing. The solutions that are going to come are going to come out of the savagery that we're going to have to live through. Because again, and one of my favorite Winston Churchill quotes is, Americans always do the right thing after doing everything else first. And it's apparent to me that we're going to have to do everything else first. And the pain and suffering that's going to come out of that, the struggle that's going to come out of Doge Boy and Ramaswamy and their wet dream list is going to be pain and suffering for the elderly, for the working poor, for the marginalized, for the people who are on the edge. Those are going to be the people who are going to be affected. And the hope is that we, those of us still fortunate, pay attention, because understand, that's our future. Because I look at my relative, you know, never took a government handout, never wanted anything from the government, but wanted Medicare, wanted Social Security, worked their life for it, planned on it. When that goes away, because understand, they call them entitlement programs, when they destroy the entitlements, and yes, that is you, Granny, there will be pain and suffering. And when Granny dies because, well, one of the insurers, the private insurers, One of the non-government insurers says, we're going to deny this. Can Granny last 6 months? This is the world we're coming towards. And again, I go back to, business is in the business of making money. Their product is secondary. They're in the business of enriching shareholders. They're in the business of lining their pockets. They're in the business of wealth creation, not providing you good service. So the next time someone goes, I want government run like a business, ask them if they're okay with the company that they work for running the country. Do you want your CEO running our country? Do you want the operation that you live in every day? Is that what you want for the entire country? Is that the mission? I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, Rick at thericksmithshow.com. Going to take a quick break. Right back.
This is Bull Falls Radio, WXCO. You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Brandon Bormans. A quiet but cold night tonight under partly cloudy skies, lows around 4 above. On Wednesday, a mix of clouds and some sun, a few flurries possible in the afternoon with highs near 17, and then a bit warmer on Thursday with mostly sunny skies, a high near 24. Right now, it's 12 degrees.
Nightlight with Pete Schwalbe.
I drew my brother's name 1 year and we went to the mall and I said, hey, while you're in there, grab me a Christmas card. We're doing the gift exchange later. So he walks upstairs, gets the card, hands it to me. I sign it, Merry Christmas. Love, Pete. And that was my gift to him that I made him pick out, pay for, and retrieve. He's like, you are the laziest, cheapest. It was absolutely beautiful.
Nightlight with Pete Schwalbe. Weeknights from 6 till 8 on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, you know, as we were saying during the campaign, the Biden plans are actually working. The economy's doing really well. And, you know, come January 20th, Trump is going to say, this is the greatest economy ever. And you know the red hats are going to be running around saying how wonderful the economy is and how fabulous things are going to be and all of that. But you look at the CHIPS plan. It's working. It's doing what it was supposed to do. Actually, the U.S. is growing in chip production much faster than China. And China's actually slowing across the globe. This is what policy looks like. Strategic, smart policy. I'm here to share some thoughts on what this is, what it's doing, what it means going forward, and maybe, you know, how this is going to affect the Trump administration. I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come talk with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, great to be with you.
So what do you make of this? I saw a report said U.S. chip production up. China is kind of slowing, not just against the U.S., but across the globe, Europe, Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, all of that.
Imagine that. You have a strategy, you have a policy, you have investment, you have sanctions, and then you are able to change the shape of the market. You know, and that's exactly what's happened with semiconductors. And first, let's say why this is important. I mean, because no one actually really handles a semiconductor. I mean, I can think of maybe one occasion in my life where I have. And so you don't see these things, but they're in everything that we utilize, from our smartphones to our missiles to our automobiles that has, you know, they have dozens of them, our appliances, just any, you know, what we're communicating on now, you know, everything has semiconductors. And so they're the framework of our digital electric economy. And who makes them really matters, especially the very high speed ones when you get into AI and other sorts of technologies. And so it does. This is something where the United States lost its lead a long time ago and really fell into a hole. And so that's why we have this CHIPS Act, you know, to try to get that back. And it involves investment in our own chips, involves sanctions on technology going to China, so that they just can't kind of like cut and paste our innovations and utilize them as their own. And you're seeing this show up in the data. And this is what you're alluding to, is that, you know, our chip production is going up and investment is going up. It's also going up with our allies, which is good because they're making similar investments too. And the one big place in the world where it's going down is in China. And so, you know, China's not going to control this market anymore. And that is undeniably a good thing. And that's a win for our security.
Absolutely. And you said a moment ago, we lost it. And then my mind went, did we really lose it, or did we give it away?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. Yeah, we did. You know, it's interesting because there was a battle in the late 80s and the early 90s over the first round of semiconductors with Japan. And folks were very concerned about Japan coming to dominate this. And you may even remember this. I know I do. It was kind of the beginning of my career. And so there was a little bit of policy put into place, a little bit of investment. We had a thing called Semitech that was stood up in the United States, and there were some voluntary restraint agreements put on Japan, but it was all very temporary, and it turned out to be pretty ineffectual. And so at that point, before that, we made about one out of every three semiconductor chips that was utilized in the world. And that shrunk all the way down to less than like 9 or 10%, even though we consume a lot of them. And then China's share just went way up as it entered the market. So this really did have an impact. Obviously, it had some impact on jobs. There's no question about that. But on our ability to have these critical technologies and have them be American made, or at least with respect to our allies, to have them to have skin in the game as well. I mean, that was something that is quite problematic. And the other thing is, you know, the other thing that matters, and we all experienced this, is it's really bad to have a supply chain like that concentrated in an area of the world where there's a lot of instability.
Right.
Whether it's the South China Sea, or China decides to do something bad on Taiwan, or even a tsunami or whatever. And we saw what that did, you know, to our economy, and it really had a bad, bad impact. And so the more that we can get back, the better for us.
And I would argue not just in bad parts or troubled parts of the world, but being dependent on anyone, I think, is a bad thing. Even our friends, because in times of crisis, they're going to take care of themselves first. And I think we saw that during the pandemic. Try to get an N95 mask during the pandemic, or some of these chips, because there were a lot of cars that were sitting on car lots that, well, you could buy them once we get the chips for them. So yeah. I hope we learned a lesson. And I think that's what the Biden plan was really all about. And I see it as something that's working. It was smart policy, and I think it's working.
Yeah, you're right. And so you said, you know, we gave it away once, and we did. And we did it because of free trade, and we stopped investing in it, and we stopped caring about it. You know, I'm using the royal we, because a lot of us did care about it. And so that could happen again.
Yeah.
I mean, if the Republicans decide to roll this back, we will be giving that away again. And I see some of the rhetoric, and some of the rhetoric is disturbing. I think what gives me a little bit of hope is that where a lot of these investments are being made, you know, in Texas and in Ohio and in North Carolina and Georgia and other states as well, Indiana, you know, there's Republicans who care deeply about the success of this, you know, and you know, is Trump or some of these budget cutters or, you know, disbelievers in industrial policy really so hell-bent on dismantling this that they would want to have a bunch of half-built factories, you know, in these communities. And then we would be even more dependent on China and Taiwan than we were before. So it just seems like that would be a total waste of time. So maybe it's like one of those, like, we're going to repeal the Affordable Care Act things where, they talk about it a little bit, but they know that they can never do it because it would be a disaster. It would backfire. Maybe this is the industrial policy version of that wreck.
Maybe, but you know, I think it's not just chips. I mean, I worry about all of the investments in green technology, you know, all of the battery technology, all of the stuff that we've invested in. I worry about that stuff being rolled back. And as you've pointed out, half-built factories or newly built factories that are now going to eventually go belly up just for the talking point of, see, government can't do anything right.
Yeah, and it's because someone else did it, right? And so, you know, this is the thing that I do think that there's some people in Trump's world who understand this and who get this. And there's certainly some Republican senators who have, I think, a pretty reasonable outlook about some of this. But I think what worries me is that Trump will come along and say something like, well, tariffs alone will fix this. You know, that's all we need to do is to have a tariff. And look, I'm a big trade hawk. I'm a believer in utilizing tariffs as a instrument of our economic policy, both to get rid of unfair trade practices, to help level the playing field, and to help reshore critical industries. I believe in all of that. And I've supported a ton of tariffs along the way. But I will also say that it is not a holistic strategy. You know, that alone is not going to fix a lot of things. And so if you do it in conjunction, kind of like Biden did, where he had tariffs on a lot of imported semiconductors at the same time that we're building up our own industry, that can work. And so maybe Trump will never say that and keep that going. But yeah, tariffs alone are not going to be enough to make sure that we're manufacturing semiconductors in the United States. It takes a holistic policy to make that happen.
No, I'm with you. But for me, just from a national security standpoint, I don't want our smart bombs, which need these chips to be smart, to be manufactured anywhere but here. Because, you know, during a time of war, I don't know that we're going to be able to call up China and go, yeah, you know, we really want to bomb you, but we just don't have the right chips. Can you send those over? I just don't know that that's going to work.
Yeah. I mean, how many movies have you seen where some enemy is able to disable all of our devices at one time, right? Or our infrastructure or stuff like that. And you see you think that's fictional, but, you know, there's a little bit of truth in there, right?
Well, I remember the whole Huawei discussion.
You know,
our military not using communication tools that were made in China seems rational, seems reasonable to say maybe we don't have a potential enemy have access to our communications because they somehow manufactured a chip that will send them a signal as well. Maybe I'm just being hyper paranoid and hyperbolic and all of that, but I'd rather err on the side of caution.
Look, I agree with you. And, you know, like we know, you know, from like smart cars that, not, you know, if it's made in China, unfortunately, we don't have a lot of made in China smart car kind of electric vehicles in the United States and hope to keep it that way. 90% of the data they collect goes back to Beijing. And so what do they use that for? No. At the same time, we know that China's got a lot more sophisticated hacking and, you know, they got deep inside our Treasury Department. They've got deep inside our utilities. They've gotten deep inside our telecommunications networks. And we're still trying to figure out how deep it was. So this isn't just like some dude on a couch, you know, in a basement doing stuff. These are sophisticated attacks made by military units of the People's Liberation Army that are doing this. And that can be really bad. We just want to, and this is, again, not about just like hating imports in general. This is like, we do not want to give away the keys to the kingdom here, right? You know, and we want to make sure that at a minimum, we're trying to deter the worst things from happening. And so that's why we have the chips policy. That's why we need to be vigilant about this and to do some tariffs as well.
So you've talked about tariffs a bunch here. Trump ran on universal tariffs. We're going to tariff everything. Everything in the country, going to have a tariff on it, no matter where it comes from. Even Mexico, because Mexico is going to build the wall and pay for it. And tariffs, I guess, are going to be the new wall. What are we hearing on the universal tariff plan?
Well, you know, it's been reported that some of his advisors are developing a plan that would have broad-based tariffs, but only on strategic goods, right? So they'd apply to some goods in some countries, but they'd be what are called like strategic goods, like things that we need for the next generation of technology in the United States that are important to our national security, that are important to our economic security or to a lot of supply chains. And so that's a pretty big list of stuff, but it probably doesn't include things like avocados and coffee and bananas, you know, stuff that we just don't make a lot of right. in the United States, but that, you know, people like to consume. And why raise costs that way when you're going to have tax breaks that are, you know, going to be disproportionately for corporations and the wealthy, unless you want to redistribute in the wrong way, right? So so I do hope it's strategic. Now, Trump, you know, I apparently on Truth Social walked it back and said, no, I'm for the universal tariff, probably to increase his bargaining power in all of this. But I do, look, I do believe we should use tariff policy to try to achieve other economic goals. I'm all for that. Again, to try to rebalance, I'm all for that. To try to defend strategic industries in the United States, I'm all for that. And also to push back against unfair trade practices, I'm all for that. And absolutely. So if a policy kind of meets those standards, then I'm willing to take a look at anything.
And look, I'm happy to hear that maybe Trump has, I don't know, found a bit of strategy. Maybe, you know, maybe flying by the seat of the pants isn't going to be the second term. I'm looking at the first term, and you know, I remember the great healthcare plan we were going to get that nobody ever saw. And I look at a lot of the plans that were supposedly out there, and all they were blank pieces of paper. I'm thrilled to hear that there's some strategy, because you know, maybe having a strategy is a good idea.
Better than a concept of a plan, right?
See, that's what I'm worried about. We've got a concept of a plan and not actually understanding what that is. But I'll tell you, there's part of me, Scott, that goes, I hope he does what he says he's going to do. And there's broad pain and suffering, and people wake up to the reality that having someone who claims to be a businessman running things like a business, especially when you're talking about government, is not a great thing.
Yeah. I'm just going to respectfully disagree with you, because as someone who wants a more aggressive trade policy, if he goes out and does all those tariffs and then for some reason it does backfire because it's too much all at once, then I think that's bad for like the fair trade stuff. And, you know, I don't want to make people more neoliberal and free trade again. That is not what I want to do. So
I completely agree with you. But no, where my mind has been is, you know, clearly we need to learn the lessons the hard way. Because, you know, one of my favorite Churchill quotes is Americans always do the right thing
after doing everything else first.
And we've been doing everything else first. And maybe eventually after doing even more of everything else, we'll get it right.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I do want to say, you know, the tariffs that were applied in his first administration on steel, aluminum, and on China, I mean, you could agree or disagree with them, but there was a process. You know, there was a rationale for it. There was a, you know, and so it was one of the more orderly exercises that, you know, had a positive impact for some people in the United States and was pretty benign otherwise. And so my hope is that they can build on that and remember what happened rather than, yeah, doing like Trump, you know, marching down one day and says, we're going to do the across the board. Let's get it going. Because I don't think that would be good.
No, I don't think it. I think the pain would be very deep and very real. And I agree with you on that. So last question I've got for you, as you're watching his team be assembled, do we have much faith in that there's going to be a strategy on trade policy? Do you have much faith that, because I know you were a big fan of his last trade advisor. Do we have a sense that potentially same kind of team?
Yeah. You know, we've had a good run here with Bob Lighthizer, who I think you probably agreed was a pretty good USTR. And Catherine Tai, who was a great USTR under Biden. And now Jamison Greer, who worked with Lighthizer, is of the same vein. And so that's good. Like, he thinks like that. The you know, his appointee on, or the, his nominee for the Council of Economic Advisors, is also pretty rational about all of this. And I do think that his, in general, you know, the only, you know, the flip side to this is that on regulatory and tax matters are probably going to be terrible. But I do think, you know, both Lutnick and Bissett are going to be, you know, are going to favor a trade and tariff policy that is going to achieve Trump's goals without, you know, going overboard. I mean, I think that is a possibility. I don't know what kind of like odds I assign to it, Rick, but I think that it's within the realm of the possible.
Well, we'll see. I mean, that's why we play the game. We're going to see how this plays out. But Scott, as always, great talking with you. I appreciate the time. Great work there at the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Hope folks check out the website, AmericanManufacturing.org. Scott, Paul, thanks so much.
Hey, Rick, thanks so much for having me on.
Always good stuff. Now, look, you know, reality, we don't know what's going to happen, but it's going to be entertaining. I want to hear your thoughts. Do you agree with Scott? Do you think maybe these guys are going to not be as bad? I want to hear it. Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1980. That was the day that President Jimmy Carter signed into law the Chrysler Corporation Loan Guarantee Act. The act allowed the federal government to guarantee up to $1.5 billion in loans to aid the failing Chrysler Corporation. The car giant had to find private financing for the loans, but had the promise of the federal government's backing. In the late 1970s, high gasoline prices had hit the domestic automobile industry hard. Japanese and European car manufacturers were increasing their market share by producing smaller, more fuel-efficient cars. By 1979, Chrysler's annual losses had soared toward $1 billion. In his remarks on the signing of the law, President Carter said, "It's important to have Chrysler preserved as a viable, competitive entity, not only to protect the jobs involved, but to protect the competitive nature of the American automobile manufacturing industry in its competition with foreign suppliers, and in the provision of good products at a competitive price for the American consumer." Officials from both Chrysler and the United Auto Workers helped to hammer out the deal in Washington. The loans helped save Chrysler, and the company did pay the money back. In 2008, the auto industry companies were once again helped by a federal bailout. Many working people have noted that the federal government seems much more quick to help corporations who fall on hard times rather than regular people. Folk musician Arlo Guthrie wrote a song capturing this very idea.
I am changing my name to Chrysler. I am going down to Washington, D.C. I will tell some power broker what they did. Iacocca will be perfectly acceptable to me. I am changing.
Like what you hear? Check out more at laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I'm sure I'm going to get some you-know-what from people going, how dare you talk nice about Donald Trump? Look, the reality is if he's going to put reasonable people into reasonable spots, I'm going to give him the credit for doing that. Do I think bad things are coming? Absolutely. I think it's going to be a giant S show going forward. I think working people are going to be the targets. And I think ultimately the reason that we're living through this moment is because Democrats are weak. And I'm going to go there. Rolling Stone. On January 6th, their headline, Trump got away with it. They said Trump instigated a violent attack on the Capitol, and in 2 weeks, he will be sworn in as president at the very same building. And why? Well, the right will tell you, nobody cares. America doesn't care. And I'll tell you what this is the greatest failure of federal law enforcement in American history. Someone basically causes an insurrection, and the people who are there are breaking the law in horrible ways, should be one of those moments in this country that we universally reject what happened on that day. And yet, the power of right-wing media, the power of corporate right-wing media in this country to say, well, it was like any other day. You know, people were walking between the ropes. You know, never mind the defecating on the floor and on desks and urinating all over stuff and smearing feces on the walls. Never mind that. Don't look behind the curtain. And the reason that Trump got away with it is Democrats are weak. And this, to me, is the reason that Democrats keep losing. Because, and I know this is hard to hear. Nobody wants to go, yeah, the Democrats are weak. And I've always said this. You know, Democrats are the people who in a street fight will offer to hold your coat. And what we need is we need Democrats who are going to go in there and fight. Now, are there some? Absolutely. Don't get me wrong. There are some people I love. But as an entire party and from some of the leadership structure, I'm sorry, Democrats are weak. Because understand, they're always trying to reach across the aisle. And in the next 4 years, will there be who's going to be the next Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema? Who's going to be the next? We need to be bipartisan. We need to work with the other side. We need to negotiate. So when Republicans come to us and say, you know, we need both your legs, are Democrats going to go, well, no, I need them. You know, just take one up to the knee. And then Republicans say, no, we really need both. Well, how about just one leg? Because this is what's been happening over the last 50 years. Democrats have continued to give in and give in and give in small amounts, you know, trying to be good governance and bipartisan and all that nonsense. And what they've gotten is taken to the cleaners because Republicans, they don't care about working people. Republicans don't care about government. They don't care about good governance. They care about winning. And they look at Democrats as the enemy. And look, you know, perfect example. You have Vice President Kamala Harris swearing in Republican Senator Deb Fischer. And her husband refuses to shake the vice president's hand. And in really one of the worst ways possible. I mean, one of the most arrogant, the kind of thing you would expect from really hateful people. Not the kind of country that we expect. Not the kind of people that we want running our government. But understand, these people, they have their view. They have their marching order. And if you are anywhere off of that line, you're the enemy. And this is where I come back to Democrats better get a spine, better steel up, and better not cave. Because I do think Trump is going to have a very hard time moving a lot of his extreme agenda. Because there are a couple of Republicans who are maybe want to keep their seats. There are a couple Republicans who just, well, they've got strong ideological cores. And Mike Johnson may go looking for Democrats to make a deal. So the question I come back to, and this is where I want to hear your thoughts. Who's going to be this legislative session's Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema? Who's going to be the ones who go, okay, you know, we'll give in. You know, we'll give the giant tax breaks to corporate America and to the very wealthy at the expense of people on Medicaid and Social Security. Of course, we're going to do what Doge Boy wants. Who's going to be that? Who's going to be that Democrat? Want to hear your thoughts. Rick at the RickSmithShow.com. The other thing, I brought up Doge Boy. Evidently, some folks are saying that Trump's growing a little tired. A little tired of Doge Boy being around so much. And, you know, Maggie Haberman evidently reported that a longtime friend told her that Trump, you know, is a one-ring circus. And that Musk's kind of around a lot. So come, you know, taking overtime, how much do you think Trump is going to put up with someone taking the spotlight? When Trump becomes president, how fast does Musk go? And then, you know, when Doge Boy doesn't get what he wants, what kind of temper tantrum does he throw? That's the entertainment right there, which is why, again, I wanted him for Speaker of the House. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Miss any portion of the program? Podcast. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick@thericksmithshow.com.
You're listening to Bull Falls Radio. WXCO 1230 AM. W255DN Wausau. And always streaming on the Civic Media app.
This is CBS News on the Hour, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
I'm Jennifer Kuiper in Southern California. Planes are being used to help fight a wildfire in the Pacific Palisades area of Los Angeles. California's governor says many structures have been destroyed, as CBS's Jonathan Vigliotti witnessed.
This home is going to go up in flames. There are not firefighters around here. They're simply stretched too thin. You can't even see through the smoke. This entire mountainside is covered in flames. Wind pushing them up to 50 feet into the sky. This neighborhood under threat right now. At least 5 homes destroyed, and you've got people in panic as they're trying to evacuate.
Powerful Santa Ana wind gusts have affected some 30,000 people. Places that are warm this time of year are not right now. CBS News meteorologist Nikki Nolan says plunging temperatures are a particular concern as far south as coastal regions of Louisiana over to the Florida Panhandle.
The National Weather Service has issued frostbite and hypo.